I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Micah White was a driving force behind the Occupy movement. In fact, he was its co-creator. He's written an engaging new book about the experience and where activism goes from here. In The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution, Dr. White says activism is broken, that despite some of the largest protests in human history, these mobilizations don't change society. So in the book, he looks at the theory, tactics, and principles of social change and looks towards the future, innovation or irrelevance. Micah White joins me now, and I'll ask him about the history that's covered in this book about Occupy and why it failed and how protest itself evolves. Micah White is an award-winning activist who conceived of Occupy Wall Street while an editor of Adbusters magazine. His work has appeared in a number of international publications, and he's been profiled in The New Yorker and Esquire, which named him one of the most influential young thinkers alive today. He directs Boutique Activist Consultancy and lectures frequently, making his home in Nehalem, Oregon. He was in Toronto earlier this week when I spoke to him as he was promoting this new book, which is published by Knopf. The website for more is at micahmwhite.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Micah White. Dr. White, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So when did you realize that activism was broken? Was it after Occupy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely took some time to set in because, you know, Occupy was so big, so amazing, that it was traumatic for us, for all of the participants, all of the creators, when it ended. And it wasn't until, I think, that I kind of moved to rural Oregon that I started to have the time to really think about the movement. And I remember one day the words, the end of protest, they just kind of popped into my head. And I started to think, well, what does that mean? Like, is that what we have right now? And that's where the idea kind of came out of. But it did definitely take some time and I think some courage to, like, think about activism and protest being broken.
So some people will look at the title of the book, The End of Protest, and think that the exercise, the Occupy exercise at least, wasn't worthwhile. And that's not the point, really, right? It's just that moving forward, there's a different way.
Right, absolutely. I mean, the core idea is that we have to constantly innovate new tactics, new ways of protesting. I've been an activist my entire life. I started when I was 13. So, you know, the idea that we shouldn't protest, that's completely the opposite of my spirit. But instead, you know, I think that there is something to be said for learning to protest in new and innovative ways, and that if we can't think of any new and innovative ways, then maybe we should just take a break and recharge and get creative. And I think that, you know, the thing is that Occupy was so powerful because it was new and innovative. And it's so important to realize that and to celebrate ourselves for that while at the same time kind of saying, okay, like, it didn't work. Like, what can we learn from that failure instead of just being so endlessly optimistic and falsely positive, which is, I think, what, you know, kind of dominant activist narrative is.
And I guess we've assumed that protest has been the same way throughout history, and you spend some time in the book, do you, in terms of talking about how protest itself is innovative over hundreds of years?
Right, yeah. You know, protest is basically a behavior that its participants believe is going to create social change. And throughout human history, people have believed that lots of different kinds of behaviors would create social change. I think that a really good example for people to kind of think about is the ghost dance phenomenon that happened in 1890 in America, where the indigenous people started basically dancing in circles because they had this prophecy that somehow these ghost dances, as they called them, would allow them to regain sovereignty. I mean, there's no rational or logical reason why dancing in circles would do that, but, you know, the U.S. government took it so seriously that it sent in soldiers, and there was, like, a massacre to prevent this dance from happening. And so, yeah, the thing to realize as an activist is that the protest behaviors that we do are culturally determined. They are behaviors that we learn that from others, and that we can create new behaviors. We don't have to just repeat the behaviors that we're taught.
So I read this book with interest because I during the whole Occupy thing, I guess I was indifferent to it. I mean, I didn't really pay attention. I mean, I paid attention to it, but it, you know, politically, that's not my side of the aisle, if you will. But I was very interested in it because it was something, as you've already said, something new. And something that had an effect on the discourse. And so I'm curious to know, having spent the time to write The End of Protest, are there tactics that Occupy could have, say, done that could have resulted in long-lasting change, a different world today, if you will?
You know, I mean, that's an excellent question. It's, of course, it's extremely difficult to answer because, you know, the reason why Occupy went the way it did is because it had to go that way. It went that way because we were testing a certain hypothesis, a certain storyline within activism. And that storyline was, you know, basically two things. The first dominant storyline was basically we need to get, if we can get millions of people into the streets doing largely the same behavior, largely unified behind a central demand, then for some reason there will be social change. But, you know, I think that Occupy also at the time was acting out a second storyline, a more minor storyline, but that played an important part, and that was called prefigurative anarchism. And it was this idea that basically we don't need to make demands, we don't need to be engaged in the political process, instead we can just kind of build the ideal society that we want to live in, and then, like, boom, revolution somehow will happen. And so that idea was dominant. I think it came from New York, but it was also dominant in Spain, and that's why their movement in 2011 also didn't engage in political process. But, you know, we tested that hypothesis. We found that it's wrong, and the people in Spain have now learned, and that's why they now have a social movement that's called Podemos that's running for office and winning elections. And so I don't think you can really say that I'm not sure we could have done it differently, but to answer your question, if it happens again, what we should do differently is this time we need to take that social movement and we need to win political power, and we need to use the power that we have, this tremendous ability to create spontaneous events. We need to create spontaneous protest events before elections in order to swing them in unexpected directions. And I think we're seeing that starting to happen in Europe, and I think that if we can figure that out in North America, then we're going to see some real stuff happen.
And what about the rise of Bernie Sanders? Do you think Occupy has had anything to do with that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, I think both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are symptoms of Occupy Wall Street. They are symptoms of the kind of hunger for social change that people have, and at the same time, the kind of realization that protest is broken. And so you have people who are demanding change, and at the same time, they're realizing protest is broken. But, you know, one thing that I think is really important for people to do is to not confuse the tail with the head. And Occupy Wall Street was the head, and Bernie Sanders, 5 years later, is the tail. He's the symptom of our movement. And so you don't chase the tail. Instead, you create another head. And so that's why it's so important to kind of dream bigger than Bernie Sanders or dream bigger than Donald Trump and realize that we can actually be in a position where, you know, the people in the streets, the people in the General Assemblies are winning elections. They're in power. They're in control. They're governing cities. They're carrying out what they want to do instead of demanding things or putting all their hopes in these single leaders. And it's really important it's so easy to regress, you know, in activism and start to kind of like forget the lessons that we've already learned.
Well, Sanders and Trump are at both ends of the extreme for a lot of people. And so what do you say to people who are comfortable in the middle, the mushy middle, mm-hmm. if you will, because that's generally where, I guess, society's been the last, I don't know, the 20th century at least.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you convince those people? Because, I mean, those people have vested interests in the dominant theory, I suppose. But they're also just apathetic, lazy, if you will.
Right, right. You know, and that's totally true. I mean, we definitely live in a time when, you know, even on the left and the right, there's this kind of, like, sense that maybe revolution isn't possible, and even if it is possible, maybe it's not even desirable, and maybe things aren't that bad, and maybe we should. And so there's this kind of, like, I think it's basically a reaction against the 20th century where revolution was such a dominant and exciting and you know, concept for people. But then, of course, when they actually experienced Stalin and Mao and Hitler, we kind of all, you know, fled from the, you know, is revolution really something that's so desirable? But, you know, to those people, I think that the core thing that they need to understand is that revolution is one of the fundamental and most important ways in which human progress, human society evolves. We need revolutions in order to break out of the old habits, the old patterns, the old ways of being, in order to inaugurate new ways of being that can kind of solve the challenges that we face. So without a revolution, we're not going to be able to solve global climate change. We're not going to be able to solve income inequality. And so I sympathize. I understand. Revolution is always something that is, you know, it's unpleasant, honestly, mm-hmm. because it's something that's dangerous. It can go in dangerous directions. But we have to acknowledge that it's like eating your vegetables. You know, like we need it. We need it. And if we don't have it, that's far, far worse because society starts to stagnate. It can break into civil war. You can, you know, basically, bad stuff happens when you're not willing to change.
Where are you on violence and violence's place in protest?
You know, that's a very important question. I get that now, like, that people really want to know, like, what do you think about violence? And I think, you know, first I want to say that within activism there is a kind of reluctance to even think about violence or to theorize about violence or to learn about violence. They basically, you know, it's like it's an area that we're afraid to touch. And so I think we need to touch it because we need to understand why we reject violence, not just blindly try to reject violence, because then you end up kind of not understanding why. So the thing about protests, the way I look at protests is that protest is a form of warfare. It's a form of warfare because it's a way of changing the politics by other means. It's a way of doing politics by other means, which is the definition that Clausewitz uses for war. So protest is a kind of war, but that doesn't mean that it has to be violent. It can be a kind of nonviolent warfare. And for me, I think that in the end, nonviolent social movements in the long term are far more effective than violent ones. And I think you can see this, for example, with ISIS. ISIS being a horrible example of a weaponized social movement or a violent social movement. You know, ISIS in the long term, there's no way that they're going to be able to expand their territory past their tiny little, like, fiefdom, you mm-hmm. know, because no one wants to live under under a government that's, like, pulling off terrorist actions in their city. On the other hand, a nonviolent social movement, it could conceivably conquer territory, could conceivably govern cities, could conceivably convince large numbers of people that life is better under some sort of revolutionary social movement than it is under this current social regime. So for me, it's a strategic question, and it's also an acknowledgement that of what we're trying to achieve, and then violence, I think, is a way that many activists self-sabotage. It's a way that we kind of guarantee that we're not going to win, you know?
Yeah, people don't take those people who engage in violence seriously, I suppose, and then that just defeats everything.
Yeah, it's a way of kind of, like, throwing a temper tantrum. You know, like, there's a certain kind of activism that is basically just a temper tantrum. It's like, I'm really upset, you know, like, I'm going to go be violent. And it's like, you know, that's like a really immature and early stage of activism that we all have to go through. I probably went through that stage too. But you know, we need to get to a more advanced stage of activism where we're able to contain ourselves. You know, if you look at the Russian Revolution, in fact, Trotsky talks about how they would tell people, like, don't protest right now, it's not the right time. Because they had a sense for, hey, we got to contain this anger, guys. We needed to store it up, and we're going to gain power if we can. And today it's so rare to hear people say, like, hey, guys, let's be patient for, like, a couple months and then really let loose, you know?
Yeah. And I guess telling the time and knowing when the right time is, I mean, that's something you talk about the book. I mean, you talk about these four kinds of revolution, voluntarism, structuralism, subjectivism. But on this fourth strain, how do you pronounce that? Theurgism. Theurgism. Because I guess the premise of that is that there's divine intervention in protest. And so
right.
I guess a lot of people don't view those that protest as spiritual.
Mm.
I mean that's probably a bad rap on protesters or those that engage in protest. But is the idea that the divine intervention sort of manifests itself in protest, is that radical in your line of thought?
Mm. Well, one of the things that I'm trying to think through is to develop a new theory of social change, which you've just kind of alluded to. So, you know, the dominant theory is that human actions alone are what causes social change, and that if only more people would do direct action and, you know, put our bodies on the line, then we would actually have social change. And that's the kind of activism that I obviously did. I went to Palestine, put my body on the line. I've blocked streets. I've been arrested for blocking streets, just like people are blocking streets today. But you know, that's not the only theory of social change out there. And so I kind of work through these other options, like structuralism, that larger economic forces are create revolutions, or that subjectivism, the idea that we have to change our minds to change the world. But then there is a fourth option, and that's that revolution is an act of God. And I'm using that term kind of like how the insurance companies use that term. An act of God being something like freak weather. No one can predict freak weather, but it can sometimes change the course of history. And that's why insurance companies say, hey, sorry, I can't insure you against acts of God. And so there are acts of God in revolution, you know, and And we, in order to acknowledge that, I think it gives us a kind of power. And I'll give you an example. I think with Occupy Wall Street, you know, with Occupy Wall Street, if you look back, there was a hurricane that struck just a couple weeks before. And I think that definitely played a role in setting the tone. You know, hurricane struck New York City. It's kind of a rare thing to happen just before the Occupy Wall Street protest. And I think that there was also people who probably dreamt about the movement and came to Zuccotti because they had dreams about it. Well, dreams are another way that acts of God can manifest and have manifested in the past. So I do think that you're right. That actually it's probably one of the most, as one person I was talking to put it, it's like I'm doing activism against activism or activism against activism theory. So yeah. I do think that theurgism is one of the ways that I'm, you know, breaking the norm. But, you know, it's good to debate these things and talk about them because we need to have a more sophisticated and nuanced understanding of protest. It kind of makes me really depressed whenever I read Trotsky and I just realize, like, they had such a sophisticated understanding of the political process that even I am, like, sitting there and I'm, like, struggling to understand the nuance of his political perspective on all the different political parties and persuasions that they had. And we've become kind of, I don't know, it's sad. Like, we've become kind of, like, ignorant about the full range of political thought.
The move to Oregon, because Nehalem, I guess, is what one would consider a rural town. Mm-hmm. It's a small town. Do you think that had anything to do with sort of your ideas on spiritualism? I mean, did that evolve your thinking in terms of how the divine, say, factors in life, say?
Mm-hmm. Definitely moving to Nehalem, Oregon, a town of like 280 people, has fundamentally changed my views on activism. I think, in the one hand, all of the urban protest tactics, the dominant urban protest tactics, don't work there. Like, for example, you couldn't block streets, you know, because it's 200, everyone's your neighbor and we don't have big stores. Uh-huh. And so it does force you to constraints increase creativity. So one of the constraints of Nehalem is you can't actually use 99% of the activist tactics that most activists know how to do. And so it does open you up to new ways of thinking and stuff like that. But I think, you know, when it comes down to it, I think what really led me to kind of consider this whole divine aspect is just really to ask yourself, like, how could it possibly be that a social movement called Christianity, which was persecuted for, like, you know, 300 years or something absurd like that, and they used to take Christians and they used to throw them into the arena and let, like, lions eat them in front of cheering audiences, and, like, they were the only persecuted belief system in the Roman Empire. How is it possible then that they conquered the whole Western world? And they didn't do it through protesting at all. There was no street protest that ushered in the conquest of Christianity. No, the way they won is because St. Paul and Constantine the Great had visions of Jesus Christ. They had dreams about Jesus. And that's why. So what does that mean? Either it means, on the one hand, if you're a secularist, you can say, well, they didn't have those dreams. Okay, fine. But either it means that God did intervene somehow, or it means that Christianity was really good at provoking dreams in people. So that might be the case, too. And I think that we can, like, you know, activists could explore that. Like, how do you create a social movement that provokes dreams in people? But either way, it's fascinating.
You know, I mentioned moving to Nehalem, and I guess you're keenly aware of the urban-rural divide that's plaguing, say, our culture today. I mean, we have that in Canada, where most of us in this country live, you know, close to the border, and so we live in urban centers as opposed to, say, rural centers. And so, for you, what are your thoughts on the conflict between the rural and the urban? I mean, do you think that'll come to a fore soon?
Yeah, I do. I do think that there is a, you know, when I look into the future and I think, well, what are the revolutionary scenarios? Because revolution always comes as a surprise. So what kind of surprises could be out there waiting for us? I think the biggest surprise is a rural revolt. I think that the biggest thing that could happen, or one of the biggest things that could happen, is some sort of revolutionary social movement that spreads throughout rural areas. Because just living in my rural community, I can tell for a fact that it's neglected. It's neglected by the federal government. It's neglected by culture. Like, you know, you sit in rural areas and you still read the New York Times or the Globe and Mail, and it's like, this has nothing to do with what's going on where I live at all. And so there's a kind of, it's great because they're not paying attention. We have more freedom out there. But it's also a kind of culture clash that's developing. There's a much different culture in the rural areas that when you know all your neighbors, even the ones that disagree. I mean, I know all of my neighbors, and I know the ones even who hold radically different beliefs than mine. You know, there's people in my community who want Donald Trump, and there's people who want Bernie Sanders, and we all live in the same tiny place. And, you know, our kids probably play together and stuff. So, you know, it is, I think, one of the places that we might see something real magical is a rural revolt, a revolt against urban culture, urban governance, and the virtues of urban society, which are really just the vices of consumerism.
And do you think that'll be that war will be waged, say, on the front of class or race, or is that or both even?
It's kind of a thing because, you know, rural areas are poorer, generally speaking. I mean, where I live, it's like a resort town in the summer, and so those people don't actually live there, but they own homes. So there's like this weird kind of like 1%, 99% thing going on.
Yeah.
I feel like we lack a word here because it's not necessarily class in the way we think about it. I think it's cultural more than, you know, it's a cultural thing. It's just like, there's a different sensibility, and that sensibility, you know, like sometimes when I first moved to the rural areas, I would say to myself, wow, it's like they're living 50 years in the, like, this is democracy 50 years ago. It really, things move more slowly there, and it's like you're almost living in like a better past, even though they have the internet and smartphones and all this kind of stuff. There's like a different culture there.
Yeah. I'd like to talk about race because out of Occupy, we've seen the rise of Black Lives Matter in the United States and elsewhere. How much of that resonance can be traced to learning from the mistakes of Occupy?
Yeah, you know, like, well, I mean, I'm black, so obviously I support the Black Lives Matter movement. And so, but, you know, from a perspective of, like, friendly criticism, I think Black Lives Matter, the thing about Black Lives Matter is that it learns kind of the wrong lesson from Occupy Wall Street. I think that if you look at what they've done, they've learned, the lesson they seem to have learned is that, you know, Occupy wasn't disruptive enough. They didn't block enough traffic or interrupt enough events, which, you know, that's the wrong lesson. We blocked plenty of traffic and interrupted plenty of events, and that's not why we failed. We failed because we were unable to, first, at one level, we were unable to make complex decisions using our general assembly. So we were never able to kind of come up with one demand or negotiate with people in power or become the people in power. We were basically paralyzed. And so, you know, that's the core thing. And I think that the second thing that Black Lives Matter has failed to do is they failed to realize that the most beautiful part about Occupy Wall Street is that we were a global movement that spread to 82 countries. And we linked up with the movements in Arab Spring, in Spain. The whole world was part of one movement. That's what we believe. And we were fighting a struggle that everyone all over the world was participating in. Whereas Black Lives Matter, you know, it's like it's a regression back to that old American style of politics where we're focused on America so much and America is the central place and everything like that. I don't think that's the way it's going to be. I think that instead what you need to do is constantly have a planetary perspective because it's really the planetary global perspective, the global challenges that we face, which is what social movements should be all about.
In terms of race relations in the United States, I mean, are they better off now than they were, say, 8 years ago prior to Barack Obama's presidency?
I mean, I don't think so. I don't know how you would necessarily judge that, but I mean, I think that... you know, it's not like we've had reparations or anything like that. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know,
For some people, just the fact that one is talking about it might be progress. And I'm wondering, is there a gauge for that?
Yeah, you know, I kind of reject that whole idea that raising awareness is somehow a mark of success. You know, I think that's mistaking the symptom with the cause because, you know, when you create a social movement that spreads across the world, or when you have a black president, or when you have a movement like Black Lives Matter that makes a lot of noise and disrupts things, of course people talk about it. and then they start to like use those words, but it's not a mark of success. It's just a symptom of the fact that, you know, it's like dropping a pebble into a lake. It always creates ripples, but you know, don't mistake those ripples for like a tsunami or anything. So, yeah, I think it's, yeah, of course they're talking about it, but you know, it's not enough. You know, getting people to talk about things is just, that's easy. That's easy stuff. And if we settle for that, then we basically might as well just give up.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of reinventing protests and what that'll look like, because I'm sure people who look at the cover of the book or even just have heard stuff about the book will be interested to know how we'll be protesting down the line. Mm-hmm. And integral to that, I'm curious to know what social media's part in that, because you know, it can be useful. I mean, it was certainly useful with Occupy, but there was a downside to it, and you talk about that in the book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, so one way of kind of conceiving what we're doing and what we're trying to do as activists is that social movements seem to be created when you, first of all, you have a willing historical moment, but second of all, you combine a contagious mood with a new tactic. So with the Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street, we combined a mood of kind of fearlessness with a new tactic, which was these general assemblies in the public square. And that's why the movement took off. And so social media, of course, is integral to that. Social media and the internet, you know, more generally, allows those moods to transmit around the world more quickly. And it allows, even more importantly, allows activists to be watching the protests that are happening anywhere. And if they see any signs of tactical innovation, they can very quickly import those into their country. So when people saw the Occupy movement, they could, you know, they imported it. Once they saw the Brooklyn Bridge arrest, they imported Occupy Wall Street into their country. Within 24 hours, we had like 1,000 encampments. And so when we look at the future of protests, what we're going to start seeing is we're going to see that people are realizing that they can ask participants within movements to do even more complex behaviors. And they'll start to understand that we can ask participants to do the most complex behavior, which is let's develop complex decision-making processes, let's run for political office, nominating delegates from within ourselves, let's somehow govern countries. You know, like, for example, I think I'm really inspired. There was just this election in Myanmar, and the person who's in charge, because they disqualified, you know, the woman opposition leader, mm-hmm. she like picked someone else who's going to kind of like be a delegate for her. I think that's kind of beautiful. It's kind of like how a social movement could do it. Like a social movement, yeah, someone has to occupy the position of president, but they're really a delegate, and they really are just like kind of a figurehead for the movement's desires, which are created kind of consensus based, or maybe not consensus based, but at least you know, group based and group oriented. So that's kind of what I see coming.
So the anarchist has a place in politics?
Yeah, anarchism, I mean, of course, anarchism is a rich and important part of politics. You can't get rid of it. But I think that the highest level of anarchism has to be, it has to stop being, you don't represent me, you don't govern me. It has to be, I govern myself, we govern our community. And that's really how we're going to have a kind of egalitarian society. We have to be able to get to the point where we're capable of winning elections in multiple countries in order to carry out a unified agenda. So it's not just being a Bernie Sanders. It's more about being like Occupy spread to 82 countries. What if we had won elections in 30 countries? You know, like that's the level of sophistication that we need to be thinking about.
You talk in the book about this part of the world in which we live, and you live in Nehalem, and I live in Vancouver, this part of the world known as Cascadia. What could happen here, and because you talk in the book about just how this part of the world is ripe for change.
Yeah, I really imagine like that you could see a revolutionary movement kind of sweep throughout Cascadia. I mean, I'm not the first to point this out. There's people like Ecotopia, of course, famously kind of like imagines this. But I think now with the ability that, you know, with these new tactics and tools of social movement creation, I see that there's a lot of, and also the pressure now, the whole border thing is becoming a real issue in this world, because we have not only war refugees from Syria, but we have climate refugees. And these borders are now becoming some sort of impediment to, I mean, people are dying and starving because of these borders. And so what's beautiful about Cascadia, which is a bioregion that extends into Canada and America, is I imagine that you could create some sort of social movement that inspires people to gain control of their local cities, and then somehow do activism that breaks down those borders, that somehow you know, infuriates the Canadian and American governments by refusing to see a distinction between the cities of Cascadia and seeing them all as part of one sovereign kind of state. These are all just kind of like, you know, just ways of think, ways of helping activists broaden their horizon of possibility. I think the main thing that's happened is that we've kind of lowered our horizon of possibility, and we start to see that we can, we start to believe that we only can do small things like raise awareness, whereas, you know, we can really do amazing and big things like govern whole countries of 300 million people and change the course of destiny, solve climate change, you know, all this kind of stuff.
So you are not without hope.
Mm-mm. No, one thing I've learned from the study of history, the history of revolution, is that revolutions always happen when they seem least likely. It's some strange paradox, but there's, you know, it's rare, it's very rare that people sit around and think, ah, yes, I believe there will be a revolution tomorrow. No, no. If you ask the people who went to the Tahrir Square uprising in Cairo, if you said to them, if you asked them 6 weeks before or a month earlier whether or not Mubarak would be overthrown, they would have said no. And when we asked people just a few months before Occupy Wall Street if there was going to be some sort of revolutionary moment in America, they said no. And so I remain optimistic because, you know, I've learned that humans are not able to tell when we're about to have a revolution. Instead, you got to maintain optimism. You got to hone your revolutionary instincts and intuition, and you got to just be ready. You know, you got to be ready to jump on it.
So when you look at say the future, I mean, into November of this year and the election in your country and beyond that, do you have a sense, because you've looked at history and you know where the world is at this point, about how it'll all turn out? I mean, what's the future for your kids, say?
I mean, that's a tough question. I think things are really unpredictable. I think that people really, they're hungry for change at the same time as they're starting to understand that protest as they know it doesn't work. So that can be kind of a dangerous situation. There's that famous quote from President Kennedy, of course, that says, you know, those who make peaceful protest impossible make violence, you know, protest, or make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. So you know, it might be on the one hand that we're getting to that kind of place where people are angry enough that they're that bad things are going to happen. Or it might be that we're getting to the place where activists are, you know, are right now already thinking about the event that is going to really inspire us again. I mean, very few people had heard about Occupy Wall Street before as a success. It might just be that we're just blind to a process that's already about to happen. You know, but I think that the main thing to do is just kind of maintain a long-term perspective, and it's so easy to get focused on the elections, and ultimately the election is just, it's a political illusion. It's a spectacle that kind of distracts us from the revolution that we're trying to spark around here. But I do maintain real optimism, and I think I think with a little bit of innovation, we're going to see some of the greatest social movements that, you know, in human history in the next few years.
Well, what have you done to say deal with setbacks and disillusion? I mean, what do you do day to day when you know you might think you're hitting a wall, say?
Yeah, I mean, you know, adversity is part of being an activist. There is, I think, what I do, you know, I experienced a lot of adversity, obviously, with the collapse of Occupy Wall Street and all this kind of stuff. But the thing is that once you acknowledge that adversity is part of being an activist, then you just have to kind of keep pushing. You know, I don't know how to answer that question other than just to say that, you know, I just accept it as part of the process, and that I've learned from my own personal experience, you know, I've been an activist for 20 years, and so in those 20 years, I've had, you know, a dozen or half a dozen, like, really exceptional campaigns that spiraled outside of my control. But in the meantime, in the years in between, things have been kind of, like, you know, quiet or lame or whatever like that. So for me, it's just kind of like, as I get older, I'm getting more attuned to the cycles, the revolutionary cycles, and just kind of like actually being happy for times of adversity, because you can rest a little bit, you can read history, you can bone up on your understanding of philosophy, you can prepare yourself spiritually, mentally, physically. Just kind of always staying hungry, you know.
Yeah, and I'm talking to you on the 16th of March, which is your birthday, your 34th birthday, and mine is in a couple of days. So I found in the last week or so reading your book, just feeling really down about how much you've accomplished in your 34 years as opposed to me.
No, it's not real. It's an illusion. That's just like, you know, that's nothing. It's not real. So, I don't want to like harp on the adversity that I have faced, but it's all an illusion. It's all an illusion. So we're all here to like fulfill some of our own purpose. And there's this weird thing that I've noticed because I'm interested in like artistic and creative people. And, you know, and some people like writers, you know, some writers, they have early successes. And then some writers like Zabald, you know, like they didn't even start writing until like 50 or 60. And then they eclipsed every single person that came before them. So it's like, you know, you shouldn't be jealous of me at 34. I might be jealous of you at 68, you know, like. Yeah.
So what's validation then at this point in your life? I mean, putting out a book like this is it's a hell of an achievement because, I mean, people are reading this. Well, we'll read this book with great interest.
Of course, I'm grateful. I'm grateful. Absolutely, I'm grateful. But at the same time, again, the book is like a symptom. And so for me, what I'm doing is I'm hungry for the next eruption, you know, and I also, I'm patient, and I also, at the same time, I know it could take some time. You know, Occupy Wall Street, there was a lot of things about, I couldn't have created Occupy Wall Street on my own. You know, I created it in collaboration with Cullet Adbusters, and Adbusters had to exist for 20 years before he was able to create it. So, you know, so there's a kind of, so for validation for me is I want to be part of a real revolution that really changes the political system, that puts wholly different people into power, and I'm hungry for that, and I keep fighting for that. So that would be the real validation. And I think the book for me is that's the reason why the book is important to me is because we need to train a new generation of activists to be more sophisticated about how they think about protest, and that's what my book is attempting to do. If people read this book, then whether or not they agree with it, they are going to be so much more sophisticated in the way they think about activism, so that the next time we have something like Occupy Wall Street, we are going to be so much stronger in the streets. I just have a feeling.
This is an engaging book, and I've enjoyed reading it and our chat today. Congratulations on it. Happy birthday.
Thank you very much, and happy birthday to you in a couple days.
Thank you very much. The book is called The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution. It's published by Knopf. Its author, Micah White, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunta.